go.
Welcome back, Bill Scher.
Thank you, Matt Lewis. Good to be back.
We missed you, but, you know, it's August, and Congress is on recess, and this is when we ought to take some time, spend with our families, and kudos to you. I'm out next week. You spent a couple weeks. How are you tanned and rested?
I did get a little tan. That's because I was pushing a stroller up a giant San Francisco hill every day, trying to get my 2-year-old to nap and not always wearing my proper sunblock. But with the qualification that a family vacation is not really a vacation, we had a good time in San Francisco. It's the best food town. There's just, I mean, I'm an East Coast guy. I lived in San Francisco for a few years. I never could fully embrace being a West Coast person. But I feel the food argument is just, is not debatable. So we do get to visit San Francisco. We just go to all our old haunts and, you know, not worry about what we're spending on food. You know, we try to be cheap other places, but there's no reason to cook at home when you're in San Francisco, is my opinion.
Well, I agree. I like San Francisco, and I like good food, and I also agree about the vacation thing. And in fact, I tell my wife, and this is like so true. Like after a weekend, I come to work to get rest. I really do. I come to my office on Monday mornings to rest. To get rest after the weekend, with the kids. God love them. You know, they're great, but I literally come to work to get rest. Now, imagine if you had a job where you couldn't rest. No wonder people go insane.
But good to be back here, and I see the world is just as messy as when I left it. So we have plenty to talk about.
Arguably worse, but yeah, I mean, different things, you know, it's either a caliphate or an Ebola outbreak, one or the other, you know.
So I try not to care about Ann Coulter because I truly believe she is not relevant to anything. I don't believe she impacts the outcome of world events. I don't believe she is a shaper of opinion in even Republican circles. Yeah, you know, I just believe she is effectively a stand-up comic to the far right. But there's also the train wreck fascination. You know, how ridiculous can she get to merit attracting attention to herself? I thought her piece attacking soccer was the stupidest you could go. But again, I was mistaken. She's now saying, doctors, it's your fault if you contract Ebola, if you decide to travel to Africa to take care of sick people. Am I properly characterizing the argument?
Well, you know, you're not misrepresenting it. I mean, for me, it took on, for me and Eric Erickson and others, it took on an even worse tone in a sense, because this was the one doctor, this missionary, he was part of a Samaritan's Purse, you know, which is a missionary operation.
Is that Franklin Graham?
Yeah. At least that's my understanding. And so, I mean, he was there to heal people and to help people, but it's also part of a faith-based larger message about Christians, you know, the Great Commission, go into the world. And this is showing compassion. And, I mean, obviously you're helping people for the sake of helping people, but also you could argue there is an evangelical message attached that folks see that when Christians come in, when Americans come in, whatever, they're doing good works. And so I would argue it's even worse than you suggest.
But it also raises the question, why would she cavalierly attack an evangelical organization? That's a strange thing for her to do.
I think there's two things at play here, Bill. Number one, I think, is the fact that she likes to get attention and write columns that get clicks. And I think the way to do that is, if you and I were here sort of jousting about, you know, take any topic, and we're sort of like, well, on one hand, you've got this, and, you know, you might say, Well, I guess you could raise the question, is it a smart idea to go to Africa? You know, is that a good idea? Take that and double down on it. So I think that's sort of the model, the template for her to write a column, is to come up with a sort of a debatable idea on the fringe and then to double down and go all in. There's no equivocation, no on one side this, on the other side that. I think that's, so part of it is shtick. But Bill, I think there's a larger thing happening here, which is an interesting schism on the right, where you have people who I think put their conservatism as an outgrowth of their faith. And I think that's Eric Erickson. If you get to the heart of it, I think deep down, I know, you know, like us all, he sometimes probably says things and has written things that don't reflect that, but we've all done that. But I think at his heart, Eric is driven, his conservatism is an outgrowth of his faith. And so you see him coming down on a very different side of this issue than I think Coulter is really representing a growing zeitgeist, which is a more angry, Tea Party, inward-looking strain of conservatism that wants nation building at home. And doesn't really care about, you know, this touchy-feely compassion stuff and about going out into the world. So I think this is actually, this schism between these two is actually is part and parcel of a much larger debate happening on the right.
Well, yeah, you wrote a piece, if I can segue into immigration, you know, you wrote a piece last week saying that we should be taking our belief in American exceptionalism and applying it to, holding a hand out to these children who are escaping, you know, violent situations in Central America.
Right. Well, you know, right.
Which is a view that a lot of conservatives are not embracing right now.
Yeah, you know, Reagan quoted the Shining City on a Hill. I think that was Jonathan Edwards originally. And when we think of a shining city on a hill, we kind of think of America as this beacon of hope, and that's certainly part of it. But, you know, apparently what he also was getting at, Edwards was, and I think it was Edwards, what he was getting at was that America is also, because we're held up, we need to be beyond reproach. We need to sort of summon us to our better angels. So there's two sides of American exceptionalism. On one hand, you could say, get all chesty and like, yeah, man, we're America, you know, defending champion, two World War winners, you know, that sort of thing, right? And that's cool. I'm down with that, right? But the other side of American exceptionalism is saying, yes, because we've been so blessed, we have a responsibility to, you know, if much is given, much is expected, essentially. And I don't think sometimes conservatives, we don't get around to that second part of it anymore. That's kind of been left off a little bit, or not emphasized. And what I'm suggesting is that that America needs to really, America is great because it's good, kind of thing. The argument attributed to Tocqueville. I'm not sure if it's apocryphal or not, but anyway, it's a good sentiment. And what I'm saying, I think there is a strain right now out there that basically is fear based. There's a lot of fear, understandably. There's a lack of trust in institutions, and when people become afraid, they start hoarding, they revert to tribalism. These are all understandable human impulses. But it flies in the face of the sort of Reagan optimistic conservatism that I ascribe to. And so, again, this all plays into the same fight that's taking place. Is conservatism a pessimistic, negative worldview about holding on to the scraps, about living in a world of scarce resources where we're all fighting each other to keep what we've got? Or is it a belief in growth and that we can grow the pie, that we can be a shining city on a hill, that our best days are ahead of us? There's a fight over that, you know, and I think I'm on the side of Reagan, but, you know, This is a big discussion. It's not even a big discussion because no one's talking about it except for me and a couple of other people, like a week probably.
I feel there was a pretty big rift exposed in the House just last week, and I don't believe people fully grasped what the division was and why Boehner's original bill was so reviled by conservatives. And I tried to explain it in a piece at Real Clear Politics earlier this week. There seem to be two components that that Boehner and the leadership were not in step with the rest of the Republican caucus on. The one that's gotten the most attention is Ted Cruz, who whipped the notion that we should not spend any money on this border situation unless we scrap and overturn Obama's executive order from 2012 called Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, which effectively gives temporary but renewable waivers to undocumented immigrants who came here when they were younger than 16 and who are now currently younger than 31. So even though that executive order doesn't apply to the kids coming, it's a defined parameter of people that it applies to. It doesn't apply to any new arrivals. Conservatives are arguing, well, it's made the law ambiguous and start all these rumors, and that's the real reason. It's not the drug violence, it's this. And so we shouldn't spend money.
I think it is probably possible. It could be a magnet whether or not it applies to people who are coming or not. So, I mean, that's sort of a in the weeds thing for people to know. You could see how, the coyotes could exploit that. Whether or not it's true, it's plausible.
Right.
So
it's sort of parallel to, regardless of the merits of that case, it's parallel to Ted Cruz's shutdown play, where he said, we should not fund the government being open unless you defund Obamacare, which it's a non-starter argument politically. You're not getting that through the Senate. You're not getting Obama to sign that legislation. And so now Cruz is saying to the House Republicans, we should not pass a border bill unless we scrap DACA. So
you're exactly right, Bill. And it's history repeats itself. It's the same exact move. I guess this is his move, and
it's a move without an end game. It's a move that is designed for gridlock. And so I think it begs the question: where do you go from here? But there's one other piece of this that I just want to explain that I think people know even less of. But your publication, Daily Caller, is where I learned about it, because the Boehner bill, the original Boehner bill, there's this issue about how the Central American children are treated differently than the Mexican children under the William Wilberforce human trafficking law from 2008. That if you're from a contiguous nation, the Border Patrol can say, hey, kid, do you really want to go back home to your parents? And the kid might say, yeah, I totally want to go home to my parents. And then they can just take him back to their parents in Mexico. You don't put him on a plane to get him back home. And the immigrant rights advocates argue a kid really can't answer that question fairly because they don't know the situation that they're in. They might say, sure, I'm going back with my parents, but that might be a death sentence for them, so it's not really as voluntary as it sounds. Therefore, the way the law treats Central American kids, the immigrant advocates like, because it requires HHS to take them in for at least 72 hours, provide care, food, and shelter, and give them some legal guidance to say, okay, here's what your legal options are. It actually doesn't require judicial review, but it effectively puts you on that path. So The whole argument was, how do we get the Border Patrol to have the same flexibility for Central American kids as the Mexican kids? The Boehner bill, instead of simply saying the Central American kids are on the same page as the Mexican kids and the Border Patrol can send them home, they gave the Mexican children equivalent access to the courts as a Central American kids. They then tried to put an extra wrinkle and say, and we're going to expedite the judicial process. It has to be done within 7 days. to say we're not trying to take all the Mexican children and have them stay in America indefinitely for 2 years until they wait for a hearing. But the Ted Cruz wing didn't buy that language and were arguing that they were going in the wrong direction and expanding court access, and the kids are going to stay here longer and stay here permanently, yada, yada, yada. That made the Boehner bill untenable to the Republican caucus. That had to get scrapped. The DACA repeal got forced in there. And now you have a situation where I feel Boehner was actually trying to propose a good faith compromise, which it didn't get treated as such because the money he put on the table was much less than what Obama wanted. But you can haggle over money.
Yeah. No, I agree. The Boehner bill is for no nothing's it wasn't perfect, but it seemed like a pretty prudent, good idea to me. I mean, but, you know, it seemed to be a decent effort, you know, and you know, a couple of things that you didn't stress, but I think are important are, you know, one of the problems are that people who get in this process currently don't show up to the hearing. Well, the Boehner bill would have solved that problem because the hearings have happened within 7 days, but they would have been in the custody. So you would still be determining, are these folks refugees who need to have some sort of an asylum here, or are we going to return them? You'd still be making that judgment call, but instead of sort of letting them go for 2 years or something, and then maybe they don't show up to a hearing, they would be within the custody. So the hardliners like Cruz should have actually liked this idea, should have supported it on those grounds. But I think it was also compassionate in the sense that it's still going through this sort of hearing process, albeit expedited. I like the fact that it applies to people equally, whether you're from Mexico or Honduras. So there was a lot to like about it, but here's the sort of unspoken thing, Bill, is that it didn't really matter because the Democrats, and this is an indictment on them, in my opinion, the Democrats were not going to, you know, the Senate left town, didn't even vote on it. So the Democrats...
Well, it was filibustered. There was a Senate bill that was filibustered.
The Democrats weren't going to support this. President Obama said that, you know, or at least his spokesman implied he would not support this. So really what Republicans could have done is they could have passed this Boehner bill, which I think is decent. I think it's something they could have been proud of. With little fanfare, they could have quietly passed this bill last Thursday, and they could have slid into recess with a small PR coup, knowing they had done the right thing. And instead, what they did was drama and turmoil for 24 or 48 hours over passing a bill that they might think is marginally better, but probably has more political baggage and downside to it. But they also just reinforce the notion that they can't get along, that they're hard to placate. And so it ended up being a really grasping defeat from the jaws of what would have been a very small but still a victory.
Well, I would take it one step beyond that. I mean, the Boehner bill effectively kept separate the child migrant issue on the border right now, kept that separate from the broader immigration reform debate.
They're two different things, right? I mean, you could argue that there's a magnet effect.
Not anymore.
You could argue that there's a magnet effect, but let's be honest. I mean, there is a border crisis. It makes perfect sense that you would address that independently and then deal with DACA if you want. Now, Bill, just, you know where I stand on that. I actually support, you know, the Enlist, the Dream Act, but I think that it ought to be passed legislatively. So I don't like the president unilaterally doing this. So I have kind of a nuanced take on it. I don't like the executive orders or whatever that make it happen. But if it were up to me, Congress would do it.
Right. Also, but now you have a situation where, you know, Boehner was trying not to have everybody be on record, on a immigration reform matter, and just deal with the child migrant issue. Now, not only are they on record, they're on record saying, not only should we end Obama's program, it effectively says, if you're in the program now, you're going to get deported when your two-year waiver is up, because we're not going to let you renew the waivers anymore. So now the Democrats can run on saying, these people want to deport the Dreamers directly. They're on record saying that. Nearly every single Republican, save for 11, voted for that. And it gives Obama even more justification to do his executive order, which is expected, you know, probably in about a month or so. And that could well become the defining issue of the entire midterm election.
I doubt it. I don't think it matters in the midterms, honestly. I think it's part of the long-running narrative that hurts Republicans with Hispanics. But look, I wrote a piece last week at The Week, Bill, that said, you know those construction, the signs at like factories that say it's been 150 days since the last accident or whatever?
Right.
Republicans need those signs hanging like at the RNC, the NRCC or whatever. Like how many days since the last incident? Like I feel like the best strategy would be like that House Republicans, at least for the next 2 months, ought to be, you know, seen and not heard, essentially. Like it's like an umpire in a baseball game, right? Like if you notice the umpires there's a problem, like you shouldn't notice them. Like at least for the next 2 weeks, and I'm not, you know, at least the next 2 months. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that Republicans ought not have ideas and proposals or whatever. But look, just in terms of winning this election, let's see if you can string together, I don't know, 50, 60 consecutive days without being the focus of the news. Because what I tell you what happens, this is interesting because, you know, every 2 weeks, I'm writing a column for the Telegraph, and it's called the American Way column. So I have to come up with, you know, I pitch them the idea, but it's usually like for people living in London, what's the biggest story this week in America that affects America? So I have to like think through that process, right? So 2 weeks ago when I wrote, what's the biggest story? I wrote this piece about how Obama was checking out. You know, we had the world falling apart. And he's going to fundraisers, playing golf. That was the big story. Now, a week later, last week, if I had been writing a column, I would have had to write about the Republican Congress falling apart, you know, and this border bill. And that's a problem because essentially Republicans are winning whenever they're not in the news. As long as we can focus on Obama, his failings and the state of the world become crystal clear. The only thing that makes him look good is being compared to them.
There's this, there's this divide in the Republican Party where I think the Boehner folks have generally wanted to do that. They don't want to have the onus on them. They want the onus on Obama. Have the midterms be a referendum on Obama and the Democrats, and not get caught up in putting a target on your own back with a whole bunch of specific ideas that might be considered outside of the mainstream. And the Tea Party wing has chafed at that, saying we need to be loud and proud, show who we are. And if that means we got to, you know, step on, you know, Boehner's preferred strategy, right, so be it. And I think what you have found is, you can try to duck an immigration vote. You can try to avoid, I think Boehner has consistently tried to contain Tea Party extremism, put out fires where you can put them out, let the Tea Party, you know, run to a brick wall like with a shutdown and just try to, you know, cut off the bleeding as fast as you can so it doesn't go on and on and on until election day. And immigration was one where he finds like, I can't thread this needle, let's just bury it and try to move on to something else. But you can't because the issue doesn't go away. Something's going to happen on the border that's going to put the issue back in play, and you have to deal with it. So if you're always in this defensive crouch, it can really catch up with you. So yeah, I agree with you. It's on paper, it makes sense to not make a mistake. You know, lay low, keep the spotlight on Obama. But sometimes issues force your hand.
But all they had to do, Bill, was address it with this reasonable bill that Boehner put together, and they could have ducked the issue.
I totally agree. And Boehner's bill, I mean, I take your point that, you know, Democrats weren't loving it up on it, you know, right away, but it wasn't diametrically opposed to where a lot of Democrats were. It was in the ballpark for negotiation.
Well, they certainly
I think Boehner I think Boehner had an endgame. Boehner puts it on the table that you could then sit around a table and talk about.
Yeah.
Cruz's bill is not that. You can't talk about whether or not you want to split the difference on DACA. You can't split the difference, whether you're for it or against it.
I think the Democrats behaved irresponsibly. They left town without passing something, and they signaled that they would not support Boehner's bill no matter what, which gave the Tea Party a talking point. Why pass this bill that's so horrible if it's dead on arrival? So, but
well,
look,
I mean, if Democrats maintain that kind of stance after the Republicans passed a relatively reasonable bill, yeah, I think that would have looked bad for Democrats. I don't think it's how it would have played out. I think it would have led to negotiations.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. I think you're wrong. But look, I think I do. But I mean, I hope you're right. But you know, the other thing too is, and I'm sure my conservative friends will be mad at me for saying what I said about the best strategies to shut up. But don't think of it this way. Like, we could get in this big question, like, is the best defense a good offense, or is the best offense a good defense? And we can go back and forth, and you could talk to me about the virtues of being on offense but let's just look at some observation. Like, it really does seem observably true to me that whenever we're talking about Obama, he's losing. And as soon as Republicans change the subject and insert themselves into the discussion, they start losing. You know, it reminds me of what I just interviewed Pat Buchanan about his book about Richard Nixon, The Greatest Comeback. And one of the smartest things Nixon did was he went on a 6-month moratorium, you know, or he took like a 6-month vacation and said, we'll let him chew up George Romney. Let the press, you know, and it worked, you know. Like, there is a certain wisdom to not being overexposed and to keeping a low profile sometimes. And I think we live in a day and age when the notion is you always have to be generating buzz. You always have to be talking. You always have to be defining the issue. And, like, I get that, and sometimes that's true. But it seems like right now we're in a media environment where if they're talking about you, it's bad news. So why do Republicans insist on inserting themselves in the discussion?
Since you brought up the Buchanan book,
Pat Buchanan.
I saw you on Morning Joe with Pat Buchanan. The guy's been on, you know, MSNBC. You know, he's been on the blacklist there for a couple years now. And so Jared Scober brings back. I didn't see him on TV in a while. It's just amazing that he still has got the hand chops. You know, nothing's changed.
And Joe, let me tell you, Pat's great. He's a super nice guy. Like, say what you will about his politics, but he's known. And if you ask, like, the makeup artists and the people who drive the cars, like, who's the nicest person you deal with, Pat Buchanan's name frequently comes up. Super nice guy.
So you have his book is out now, and you also have the Rick Perlstein book, The Invisible Bridge, which talks about also the fall of Nixon as well as the rise of Reagan in the mid 70s, and you kind of got in the middle of his argument with Reagan. Surely was in the Reagan administration, or did you just write about Reagan?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think he was in the administration. I could be wrong, but Craig Shirley is a longtime conservative movement guy, PR guru, and now author, a Reagan biographer. So he's been, I mean, he certainly was around the conservative movement in the Reagan world at that, you know, he's a contemporary, he was like a young guy back then, but he's been around it. He knows it intimately. And, you know, Craig Shirley interviewed in the process, I think he's written 2 books on Reagan, Rendezvous with Destiny and Reagan's Revolution. And he interviewed hundreds of people, many of whom he knew, in the process of writing these books. And it appears that Perlstein essentially used Shirley's work, Shirley's research, and didn't credit him or cite him in the book. He has a website where he does that.
So this actually came up a little bit before. And so just to clarify you, so Shirley is accusing Pearlstein of plagiarism now, and Pearlstein's saying, no, I have all the notes, they're just on a website, not in the book. And you were in the middle of a Twitter back and forth for a while, so I know you have an interest in this, so people should check out,
It wasn't a fight. I was asking him questions, and
Asking Pearlstein questions on Twitter.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because, like, frankly, I mean, I find that it's an interesting thing. You know, it does strike me, we're now in the midst of these multiple plagiarism allegations and scandals, and one of them, of course, was Benny Johnson at BuzzFeed. And that story I found interesting for a reason that some people hinted at, which is that when you have when you're a business of aggregation, where you essentially borrow other people's, like, pictures or ideas, and frankly, most websites now sort of have some aggregation, you know, some part of it where they're call it curation, call it aggregation. You could see how, like, that sort of technology might lead someone to get lazy or sloppy. And clearly, I mean, I think any of us who do this, I mean, we sort of live in fear that we might read something someone else wrote and not know that we heard it from them and use it again. I mean, there are people that I don't read because we have similar messages, and I try to avoid them because I don't want to accidentally pick up their ideas, but it happens. But I think the interesting thing here is that really, if you boil it down, I think it's almost a question of, like, technology. Like, is it acceptable to have a separate website and not to have the citations and documentation in your actual book? I think it's problematic to not have it in the book. But I think his argument, Pearlstein's argument, I think, is that, like, this is a new paradigm. So...
Right, and I understand. So basically, what Pearlstein was saying I got so many citations here. A lot of stuff that you're more likely to want to click on something and check it out on the internet than actually go over a schlep to the library and take out a book and read it. You know, most people don't really do that. So I'm going to make this more user friendly. And not make the book an extra 150 pages you got to lug around. I'm just going to throw it all up on the website, and I'll praise all the people I've cited in the acknowledgments. It's not like there's deception here.
Unless you read the book and not the website, unless 20 years from now.
But I'm sure the website's mentioned in the book as go for your backup.
This is true, but. But I think, well, number one, will the website be up 25 years from now when someone has the book, you know, whatever. But
will all the links still work, which I think is even a bigger question. Yeah. You know, is there a link rot problem? I think there's a lot of argument to be had about what's the best method here. I don't think it's fair to throw on the plagiarism charge because that suggests, you know, deception and misrepresentation, which I don't think is what's going on here.
Well,
there's a question about what's the best process for citing things in the modern era. Let's have that debate.
I think there are two debates. I think there's a really interesting question about 21st century journalism. Are the standards different? Are the protocols different? Will there be is this a new paradigm? But then there's a second question, Bill, that specifically asks, did he plagiarize? And I've seen the legal documents that Shirley's team presented where they do a side-by-side comparison. And Pearlstein clearly did not copy and paste entire paragraphs, but it does seem like he copied and pasted paragraphs and then moved things around, moved words around. And that he's sort of, he knows things because Shirley interviewed people, and that's essentially the basis for his knowing things, but he never mentions Shirley in the actual book, at least not during these citations in question. And then there's some things where, like, he uses the word festooned, which is a very somewhat unusual word that in a paragraph that's very close to what Shirley wrote and used the same word. So I think, I mean, look, I don't know, like, what is plagiarism? Is it only when you copy words verbatim, Or is it if you copy things and then move things around to conceal it? If the latter is true, then I think maybe Shirley has a better argument against Perlstein. But I do think there are two questions. Like, Shirley has an argument that plagiarism happened. I don't know if he's right or wrong, but he has an argument. And then I think we also have this larger discussion about what is the future. Like, when everybody is aggregating and when things are online, like, are the rules going, the governing this stuff going to change?
You know, this is actually very similar to, and we talked about this on a past show, with what happened to Edmund Morris's Dutch, where Morris was the authorized biographer of Reagan. He expressed difficulty how to depict what a inscrutable character, and chose to break the old paradigm and create a biography or memoir that introduced some elements of fiction into it, even though it really didn't fictionalize any aspect of Reagan's life. It created these fictional characters kind of on the periphery of Reagan to help narrate his story. And people, and since it was kind of a warts and all Reagan biography, people inside Reagan's circle were really angry about it and maligned the whole book on the basis of that novel construct. Now you have a sort of similar thing going on with Perlstein. I mean, instead of just encouraging people to read it and debate what the argument is that Perlstein is making, you're making this kind of ticky-tack argument about how notes should be cited. And you know, yeah, there you have this one example with Festoon where I would, not having read the legal documents, not having read either book, I'm not an expert on the subject, just when I glance in news articles, like that Festoon line is sort of the closest you get to maybe too close to a cut and paste situation, although it's not literally verbatim, but there's some sentence similarities there. But it's kind of like, is that the best you got? You know,
I think what you're hinting at with the Morris comparison is that it's not. There's a larger problem here, which is that there is a fear or a sense that they are rewriting history. That this is going to be a liberal take on Ronald Reagan, and so it could be that the best way to discredit it is to sort of point out the sort of non-conventional style. I do have to say, you know, the pioneers take the arrows, and sometimes people do things that are unorthodox, and they become like celebrated for inventing a new genre. But when you're Edmund Morris and you have this amazing access to President Ronald Reagan, and you're a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and with that opportunity, you invent fictional characters, it seems like an imprudent career move to me. But I think it does make it easy for people who want to dispute your take on Reagan to diminish and impugn, you know, the actual work and that was done.
Well, I think in the case of Morris, you know, on one hand, the book still sold. It was a bestseller book, but it certainly has not been treated remotely as reverentially as Morris's other work on Teddy Roosevelt or on Beethoven. I mean, the Teddy Roosevelt stuff is sort of considered like his real masterwork. So on one hand,
and his wife,
you know,
has a new book out on Clare Booth Luce as well.
Right. So on one hand, you know, probably Dutch is not seen as the quintessential Reagan book the way Morris might have wanted it to be, although he's expressed no regret about how he approached it. It didn't damage the rest of his career. People still ate up his Teddy Roosevelt books, and they won awards, and it's considered a landmark trilogy. In Perlstein's case, you know, Perlstein has such a loyal following, and it's not solely a liberal following, but he's definitely from the left, and I think on the left look at him as help me understand how the conservative movement got to be where it is, and they treat him as the prism to look at it through. Being attacked by a Reaganite is not going to deter those people from buying Perlstein's book. I mean, it'll probably just elevate the the prominence of the book and have it sell more copies. So it's unlike the Morris attack. It doesn't really get into the substance of the book itself and the conclusions that Perlstein draws. So I doubt it's going to hurt Perlstein.
Well, it seems like it might be helping him. He doesn't seem too worried about it. It seems like it might actually be helping generate buzz and controversy. And I mean, look, we live in a world where you've got people ranging from, you know, Maureen Dowd to Doris Kearns Goodwin, who have been tagged with this to one degree or another. And so, you know, it's something survivable. And I do wonder, like, going into the future, if the stigma attached to this will diminish because of the different because of the nature of blogging and new media publishing and aggregation.
You probably still can't run for Senate from Montana, but otherwise I agree.
Well, and if he had brought it out himself 5 years ago or something, it might not matter, you know. But it's just the timing for him was really bad, and the fact that it was brought out by the New York Times, you know, a couple months before the election, not a good thing for him. But I will say, I mean, it is there, but for the grace of God go I. I mean, as someone who writes so much, I'll give you an example. Like at the Daily Caller, we have a template that has changed. Like when I say a template, I mean like, the way our website looks, the way the page looks is different. Like now there's like a little picture of me like in the corner, and there didn't used to be. And so there are dangerous things where, like, you know how like when you you can block copy, like indent an entire paragraph, and that it doesn't have to have quotes around it, but because it's indented, or that is attributing that you're quoting. Like, it's possible that a template could change over time, and when somebody looks at it, you don't see that indent. So it's scary that things that you've written 5 or 10 years ago, and then somebody changes the way a website looks, could change that. So, like, there are people who, like, in a book sometimes you'll just see where people, like, say, and then he said, and then they'll do the block quote. Like, I try to always, like, put in there, as the New York Times reported, you know, just so that, like, retroactively, if somebody changes the look and feel of a website, it won't mess up that indent thing. Anyway, it's a scary thing. If you're someone who writes all the time, you do not take, you do not have a sort of Schadenfreude for people who get caught up in this, or people who go on TV and say stupid things. I always also feel a certain understanding of them as well.
Well, I know you got a busy day ahead, so perhaps I should let you go.
Yeah, buddy. Good talking to you. I'm out next week, but welcome back. And I guess, you know, come when school's back in session, we will, the DMZ will be back to our normally scheduled program.
All right.
All right.
Till next week.
You got it. See ya.
Bye-bye.